The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And on this Monday, we come back to our very troubled earth, the two conventions in our rearview mirror, and we've got two detailed looks at the situation in Iraq, Syria, and the wider Middle East for you. You may have missed it, but last week one of the main opposition groups in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, formally cut ties with the terrorist organization al-Qaeda, which it has long been affiliated with. The rebranding under the name Jabhat Fateh al-Sham was to unify it as an Islamic group with its own separate mission. What is that mission? Al-Nusra, which emerged in 2012, is tightly embedded in Syrian communities and has established military alliances with all kinds of rebel groups. This could be a signal of a rapidly approaching turning point for the entire region, according to Jennifer Caffarella, fellow at the Institute for the Study of War and the author of Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, an Islamic Emirate for al-Qaeda.
What we're actually seeing is a continuation of a trend that began last year, when al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, and prominent Syrian opposition groups formed a new coalition called the Army of Conquest in northwestern Syria. That Army of Conquest proved militarily effective and seized the provincial capital of Idlib city from the Syrian regime. What we're witnessing now with the declared cessation of Jabhat al-Nusra and its replacement with a new organization called Jabhat Fateh al-Sham opens the door for a full merger of that Army of Conquest coalition. So it's a continuation of a trend wherein opposition groups in partnership with al-Qaeda are attempting to become more effective at their coordination against the Assad regime in order, among other things, to survive the combined onslaught of the Assad regime's ground advances and the Russian air campaign.
Let's talk for a moment about Assad, because there have been suggestions that really, the end game is near for Assad. He can play a standoff for essentially as long as he wants, but any idea that he's going to reclaim Syria is off the table. Does this coalition, does this combining of forces hasten whatever sort of end game there is here?
Absolutely. So the Assad regime will not reconquer all of Syria. It simply does not have the manpower to retake all of that terrain. What the Assad regime is attempting to do, despite rhetoric to the contrary, is to seize key strategic areas that will give it and ensure that it retains leverage at the negotiating table, that it retains the upper hand and does not have to submit to opposition demands. The Assad regime intends also to drag out the war long enough so that the Syrian opposition radicalizes or lose the legitimacy and the support of the international community. So in some ways, it is actually a losing strategy. It's a strategy to hold on for as long as possible and to let the situation deteriorate to the point at which the West has no choice but to accept the Assad regime or continued war in Syria.
Is part of its intent to kind of create an umbrella organization which anticipates some sort of political power-sharing talks and loses the kind of terrorist identity that would make it impossible for the U.S. and other coalition nations to deal with it?
I don't actually expect that the theory with the new branding is for this group to ever participate in a negotiated settlement. In fact, it's most likely the opposite. So the leader of al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate that has since rebranded, Jawlani, has actually come out openly in defiance of the political negotiations, stating that Syrians that participate in negotiations with the Assad regime are to be considered having betrayed the revolution and committed an act of treason. So I don't expect Jawlani is actually going to change his position. Instead, what al-Qaeda is doing is doubling down on their military support to the Assad regime in order to establish enough influence within the opposition to convince the opposition to adopt the maximalist political objectives that al-Qaeda has, which is actually the full destruction of the Assad regime and its replacement with an Islamic State.
Now, Jennifer, that sounds to me like the birth of a new ISIS.
Well, certainly. However, this group, this al-Qaeda affiliate, has been there since the start of the war. So it hasn't received very much attention in the Western policy debate, but it has been active in opposition-held areas governing, not just conducting military operations, but governing according to a very hardline interpretation of Sharia law, very similar to ISIS's. It simply hasn't gotten a lot of coverage in the West. What it is now trying to do is pull additional opposition groups into that fold.
In terms of military tactics, you described the Russians supporting Assad to prolong this. Aren't the Iranians also attempting to assist Assad in the fight for Mosul?
Well, the Iranians are indeed very active in Iraq as well. There are Iranian-backed proxy forces, you know, that are operating on the ground against ISIS that are participating in anti-ISIS operations. However, in Syria, the Iranian support to the Assad regime is direct support. It's actually, you know, IRGC, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, members directly on the ground fighting alongside the Assad regime. The Assad regime does not have enough troops to fight as many fronts as it is currently fighting. So the Russian air campaign helps the Assad regime with Iranian reinforcements on the ground to continue to conduct these operations. But both the Russian and the Iranian support is actually existential for the regime at this stage in the war.
Is this a setup for a broader regional sectarian conflict, or is this division of Syria into three districts?
I think it is actually both. So we are witnessing Syria as sort of a crucible for regional conflict. Of course, you have the direct Iranian involvement in the war, and you also have regional states backing Syrian armed opposition groups against the Assad regime. So that dynamic has always been the case. Syria is in many ways a proxy war. But the reality that the Assad regime will not reconquer all of Syria also indicates that on current trajectory, Syria will not become whole again. If the Assad regime is not going to reconquer all of that terrain and al-Qaeda is going to continue to operate in that terrain, the U.S. has a very serious policy challenge in order to prevent ISIS 2.0, so to speak, or the next wave of global terrorism that is currently incubating in opposition-held Syria.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., Jennifer Caffarella is a fellow at the Institute for the Study of War and author of Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, an Islamic Emirate for al-Qaeda. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
There's another realignment going on in the Middle East quietly. There are indications that a coalition is forming to try and contain the growing influence of Iran in Syria and in the wider Middle East. Cooperation seems to be secretly taking place between some Arab Gulf states and Israel to confront Iran. This means Palestine, which has for so long dominated the Arab world's agenda, is losing attention for the time being. Here to talk about this developing relationship and what it means for Palestine is Manal Omar, Associate Vice President for the Center for Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
I think that it's been taking place on a political level behind the scenes for quite a long time. The reality of the security being very intertwined is something that most political leaders have acknowledged behind the door and have often said this is not something we can ever take public. What we're seeing is a shift more towards the public eye and a testing of the public appetite if that they themselves can make that shift along with their political leaders.
Would you say, and I guess Netanyahu of Israel is going to go to Egypt at some point fairly soon before the end of the year, if that happens, and they do have a treaty, if that happens, would we be wrong in speculating that perhaps the Gulf states would support Israel if they decide to make a preemptive strike on nuclear capabilities inside of Iran?
It would be very difficult, again, to take any support on some type of strike, particularly in terms of Iran publicly. I think that you have a lot of almost encouragement beyond just support from private quarters and behind the scenes. I do think that there would need to be some type of consolation if there was going to be, and it may be why Egypt is taking such an interest in restarting the Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. The political sector, again, is very concerned about Iran, recognizes strongly that Israel is perhaps the other country in the region that is just as concerned in terms of the Gulf, but there is still a strong lag from the public. And even Netanyahu's visit in Egypt will reveal a lot about what's actually happening on the ground in Egypt as well. As we know, there has been a crackdown on Egyptian civil society for some time, and this will be a true test in terms of what the public, what the street can handle. What I do anticipate is that the issue of sectarianism, particularly the Sunni-Iran divide, will continue to come to the surface, and it's still very, very fragile, particularly if you look at the conflict of Yemen. I mean, a lot of the other Arab countries are very frustrated with the Gulf, and particularly with Saudi Arabia. And so a strong alliance with Israel would make, the Gulf, which is already fragile in terms of reputation, even harder.
Palestine, all of a sudden, is put on the shelf and becomes very much, down ballot in terms of priorities for the Gulf states. Every time this has happened in the past, there's been some explosion that resets the entire region. You would think lessons might be learned in this particular case. What do you think the implications are here?
I think, one of the things that I've seen with my background in terms of humanitarian work is something that I've called Palestinian fatigue, traveling through Iraq, traveling through Syria at one point, traveling through Libya. You often heard people say, well, what about us? Why is the Palestinian cause the only one, the League of Arab States, the only one that everyone discusses? In that sense, Palestinian fatigue has been taking place for a while. Nonetheless, as you mentioned, one explosion, one scene of Israelis demolishing homes or attacking Palestinians can reset the public need for some type of solution. I think that you will see, again, you're already seeing Egypt trying to restate the negotiations, trying to bring back the Palestinian to the table with welcoming from the Palestinian authorities. And I think that is a way of trying to safeguard that next explosion or safeguard the attacks that they're no longer concerned about Palestine. And I think that there's an acknowledgement that it's not something that can be permanently ignored, but a very strong frustration that they don't see any movement or any solution ahead.
Has there been any change of heart in the famously corrupt Palestinian leadership on the West Bank and, of course, the Hamas leadership in Gaza in the last 6 to 8 months?
What you've seen is the Palestinian leadership acknowledging that they have to do something. And oftentimes, when I was in the West Bank earlier this year, you would hear terms like seven-star occupation. You would even hear veiled concerns or almost veiled threats from the public saying that the next intifada may not target in Israel at all, but may target the Palestinian Authority and the issue of corruption more directly, because that was where most of the frustration was seated. As such, you're also seeing the Palestinian Authority trying to shift away from depending on the U.S. to be the primary negotiator and looking at the international community. This is what we're seeing with the bid for Palestinian statehood, with taking it to the ICC. Unfortunately, I think most of that will continue to be rhetoric and not really lead to any tangible change. It definitely won't lead to bringing Israelis to the negotiation table. And so there's a concern that the rhetoric is actually more important than the reality.
Manal Omar is Associate Vice President of the Center for Middle East and Africa at the United States Institute of Peace. Thank you so much, Manal.
Thank you for having me.
We have one last impression of American democracy to deliver to you from last month's conventions in Philadelphia and Cleveland. Scholastic News Kids Press Corps has 35 young journalists, a team of 12 and 13-year-olds covering the campaign this year, and they sent teams to both conventions. Meet Adedayo Perkovich and Maxwell Serpernant. That's the Philly team. They're excited, they're wide-eyed, and leery of anyone who would push them off of their admirable, and all too rare these days, just-the-facts approach to reporting the news.
Well, I have learned so much from covering this whole political process, and then I've been learning more. I learned more about the candidates, and from going to the events, I've learned just so much, and I've had a great time. It's been a very interesting election. I've learned that by listening to both sides, I can find out so much about the whole thing.
Adedayo, you weren't alive when Bill Clinton was president, right?
No, I wasn't.
So how do you think, objectively, he did? Do you think he helped his wife, Hillary?
I think that he was very supportive of her, and his speech was really highlighting all of the great parts of Clinton's history and all the things that she's done for people in America, and I think that he's been a great part of her campaign.
And where do you think the Democrats stand right now? Do you think they're front runners, or are they coming from behind as we start the campaign in earnest? Either of you?
Well, I think that it's a pretty close election. It's a very different election. It's very historic. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens in November. So I'm very excited.
You think it's close, Maxwell?
Yeah, I mean, it could come out either way. But as a reporter, I'm staying neutral and just staying with the facts.
It could come out either way. That sounds to me like Trump has a huge advantage. He walks in off the street, basically, Mr. Billionaire from New York, and goes up against one of the most experienced politicians in the universe, and boom, you say it's a toss-up.
Well, they have very different campaigns and very different platforms, and I think that a lot of people are supporting Donald Trump, and that is why it could be a toss-up, because a lot of people are listening to his message because it's very different.
Maxwell, as you looked at the crowds at the convention in Cleveland and the crowds at the convention in Philadelphia, did you notice any differences?
Yeah, there was a lot of excitement at the DNC, a very diverse group. They were very supportive. At the RNC, some people were tense, and a little more nervous than they were at the DNC.
So what do you think the diversity means between the parties that Maxwell talked about there, Adedayo?
I think that it really shows the difference in their messages. I mean, I think always politicians are trying to get their message to like a certain target audience and that they want to focus on those types of people. So I think that it's really showing what kind of target audience and what kind of message that the two politicians are kind of projecting out into the world and what kinds of people want to support that kind of message.
Maxwell, if somebody came up to you on the street and said, hey, I heard that Russia is controlling Donald Trump and that Hillary Clinton is a liar, what would you say?
As a reporter, I have to stay neutral, so I'm sticking with the facts. I'm reporting fairly from both sides.
But what would you say? Am I right or am I wrong? Or here's what you need to know about that? Or sure, that's what you've heard. How would you help me out?
I know a lot of people are saying that. There's no proof for either way, so I can't say it as a fact.
Adedayo, how would you help out somebody that has heard that about both candidates and wants a little bit of a briefing from you?
Both candidates have had a lot of different aspects of them shown. I think that it's important for people to recognize that, but I would like to stay neutral as a reporter.
Adedayo, a lot of people are saying that if Hillary Clinton loses, it will be because the people who normally support her, women and hardcore Democrats, just aren't that excited about her. And they maybe go, well, I suppose, and some of them stay home. What do you think of that?
I think that that's the purpose of this convention. I think that everyone's trying to build up excitement and support for Hillary Clinton and basically share her history and share all that she's done for those types of people so that she can get them to vote for her. And that's why there are so many great speakers like the president and the first lady and her husband and her daughter, that is how they're trying to build up support from those voters.
So you think the convention did the job as far as you can tell?
Yeah, I think they're really working to build up support for her. Yeah.
Do you think Donald Trump needs women and needs minority voters to help his campaign, Maxwell?
It would help him to get those votes, but his approach right now, I don't think that's his goal right now.
Do you care? Either of you, that Donald Trump is a billionaire?
Well, I think that he used that a lot in his campaign. Personally, I don't know that that is the most important factor. I think that it is attracting a lot of people, and it's showing how he can contrast to Hillary Clinton and how he is an alternative. So I think that he's using that very wisely.
Who's the coolest person you talked to, Maxwell?
I talked to Reverend Jesse Jackson about racial injustice, and he said that Hillary cares about the children. So he's supporting Hillary Clinton in this election.
Adedayo, who is the coolest person you talked to?
I also talked with a former press secretary for Senator Sanders, Simone Sanders, and she says that she's really excited to see Hillary Clinton finish her campaign and that she believes that she is the best candidate for the children. She's really looking to support all different kinds of people all over the spectrum.
Adedayo Perkovich and Maxwell Supranant, the Philadelphia team of reporters of the Scholastic News Kids Press Corps. kind of having a hard time with this one. I have to say that there was something heroic, but also a little sad talking to these young journalists clinging so strongly to the idea of objectivity. Do not prejudge the candidates. Keep your opinions to yourself. Those are principles I've had since I began my career. But for me, that's where the sadness comes in. In this election of all elections, I think we may be getting to the point where this straight down the middle idea might not apply. The comments Donald Trump has made to Khazer Khan, the man who spoke in Philly and lost his son in Iraq, those comments are extremely upsetting. I'm not the first person to come to this conclusion. In an unprecedented move, the Houston Chronicle editorial board endorsed Hillary Clinton early yesterday, saying Donald Trump's grasp of American democratic values is so flawed that it's not a question of policy anymore. Donald Trump himself is an attack on democratic values. Is there a moment where objectivity has no place? It's judgment we all need in these difficult times. Is that where we are headed in this election? Objectivity giving way to moral judgment. What a lesson for some young would-be journalists.
You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Let's revisit now the story that's very much in play as we begin this week. Those words directed at Donald Trump were from Khazer Khan, Muslim American, father of a soldier killed in the Iraq War. He spoke at the DNC. But Trump's response to Khan, in which he criticized Khan's wife, suggested the Clinton campaign manufactured Khan's speech. That's drawn intensifying criticism from both Republicans and Democrats. Khan has vowed to speak out against Trump until Republican Party leaders Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, both of whom at one point denounced Trump's comments, formally withdraw their support for the candidate.
It is their moral obligation. History will not forgive them. This election will pass, but history will be written. The lapse of moral courage will hold them, will remain burden on their souls.
That is a very high bar from Khazer Khan. With me now is Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. That is quite a challenge. This is very much alive and well, this story.
It is, and we're into day four now, John, and we're on Monday, where after a bunch of observers wondering just how much further Donald Trump would take this attack on Gold Star parents after the speech at the Democratic convention on Thursday night, Donald Trump on Twitter this morning complaining that he has been viciously attacked by Khazer Khan and that the media is now against him, which does a lot of things, guarantees, of course, that this story is now into day four.
Why did he even acknowledge it?
People are also wondering about that. I'm not inside Donald Trump's head. I can't give you much insight into his impulsivity and his motivations here. I can also tell you, if you're not aware, John, that late last night on Twitter, as I was up scrolling through this because this story keeps on developing,
right,
that Roger Stone, the master of dark arts, political advisor to Donald Trump, a surrogate and former advisor, tweeted an article suggesting that Khazer Khan is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and that his son is was a terrorist in Iraq.
Oh, my God.
That was a Trump advisor. That wasn't Donald Trump himself. But this is how this story is now developing. Now, one of the statements that you had in the intro there that you heard from Khazer Khan was challenging Republican leaders not only to repudiate the statements of Donald Trump, which they have in the past in so many different ways.
No, they don't like him. We can tell.
And Paul Ryan has been forced to come to the mics and repudiate Donald Trump when there's been instances of Islamophobia or calling Mexican immigrants rapists and murderers.
Right.
Mexican judge. We remember all these episodes they're stacking up. Khazer Khan has challenged him to repudiate his candidacy, not just his words. And back in June at a Paul Ryan press conference, this issue was already on my mind.
You asked Paul Ryan if this was a question of principle.
I did. I asked him if Donald Trump's candidacy was bigger than party, whether defeating Hillary Clinton was bigger than party, and whether a party leader like him should reject, if he's thought about rejecting Donald Trump's candidacy as a defense of the democracy, whether there was a higher principle than party.
When I see and hear things that I don't agree with, that I think are contrary to our principles as conservatives, as Americans, I'm going to speak out on those things. I'm going to be really clear. You know that. But at the same time, the last thing I want to do is help Hillary Clinton become president of the United States.
Now, that was his answer, which is essentially a tacit no. Paul Ryan issued a statement again repudiating Donald Trump's statements about the Khans. He called, said this is a gold star family that deserves honor, period.
And gold star refers specifically to families that have lost members.
Correct. Yeah. That statement nor Mitch McConnell's statement, neither of them mentioned Donald Trump by name. They simply repudiated the words. So a continuation now, and I think that Kaiser Khan's challenge has not been met.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. You thought that convention was over. Well, you were wrong.
Day four.
Welcome back.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
It's the Olympic torch show in the lead-up to the Games. It's burning bright, that torch is, in Rio das Ostras, a small coastal town in Brazil. The torch relay ends on Friday when the final torch bearer will light the Olympic cauldron in a stadium in Rio. As we get ready to light the torch, so to speak, for the next few days, our guide to the Olympic Games and all of its traditions will be David Goldblatt. He's the author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, a Herculean effort that tries to draw a line from its ancient roots to today's modern commercial cash cow.
It's an attempt to do justice to the real political and cultural history of the Olympics. I mean, there's an awful lot of books out there on the Olympics and an awful lot of guides, but very few of them will really explore, you know, what are the political, economic, and cultural reasons that people have been prepared to stage this spectacular, and what does it really mean?
And the Olympics are charting a history of what nationhood means in a way, right?
Well, it's one aspect of it. I mean, one of the paradoxes of the Olympics that it is simultaneously the greatest and most public expression of a cosmopolitan humanity that we have, at the same time that it sort of systematically encourages and nurtures a particular kind of sporting nationalism and competition. So there's a real tension in the Olympic Games, as there is in kind of, you know, the wider politics of the 20th and 21st century, between attempts to create a sense of internationalism, of cosmopolitanism, to break down borders between ethnicities and nations, to represent a singular humanity through the playing and experience of sport. And on the other hand, the most terrible sort of atavistic racist nationalism is on display. So it becomes a global public theatre for these kind of wider political and cultural struggles.
In the 20th century, during the Cold War, when I came of age watching the Olympics, you know, it was a kind of a good guys, bad guys narrative. Was that even remotely the case in 400 AD when this began?
No, I don't think there is quite the same sort of singular good guys, bad guys, simple, if effective, narrative of the Cold War conflicts. But you do have an awful lot riding on the ancient Olympic Games, which of course was only one of a whole wider circuit of incredibly important pan-Hellenic games. And so there was enormous civic pride associated with triumph at the Olympics, and one could certainly trade and bargain a victory at the Olympic Games for status and political office, and often effectively prize money once one got back to Athens or Sparta or wherever one came from. So again, with the ancient Olympics, there's also a pan-Hellenic side, the idea that despite this competition between different city-states, there is also this sense of being all Greeks and finding some sort of common ground to celebrate your collectivity.
Is it the case, I mean, we sort of think almost as a cliche that the Olympics are a proxy for actual war, that in a peaceful world there would just be the Olympics, but originally, there was a wartime context to the games themselves.
Well, not really in ancient Greece. I mean, you have the idea of a truce, which Baron de Coubertin and the International Olympic Committee have completely turned into a mythology, as if the whole of the Hellenic world stopped all of its conflicts for the Olympic Games. And this, of course, is a complete untruth. All that was agreed at the time is that there would be safe passage across areas of conflict for athletes going to the Games, but in no way were the Games ever stopped. I mean, indeed, on one occasion, there was actually a pitched battle fought at the Olympic Games in the 5th century. Mm. So the relationship between the modern Games and the ancient Games is actually very complicated. And most of what we've inherited from the IOC, who are amongst the worst classical scholars in the whole of human history, is incredibly distorted. I mean, you know, the idea of sort of amateurism that the IOC, you know, often, I mean, as late as the 1960s, President Avery Brundage is defending his contemporary sense of amateurism by saying, but that's of course what the ancient Greeks were doing. And while there was no prize money at Olympia, there was of course a gigantic professional circuit of sport across the whole ancient world. And there was no way that, you know, taking money or prize money from the Isthmian Games or the Pythian Games would have disbarred you from the Olympic Games. And that's part of the problem with the IOC, and indeed their whole way of talking about the Olympic is that they have systematically gone to the history and distorted it for contemporary political purposes.
Great story and fabulously told. The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. David Goldblatt is the author. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's one more go-around with the Harry Potter phenomenon, it turns out, folks, which you'll recall in 1997 began with what line, Isabel Angel?
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of Number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Not only is Isabel Angel a producer on The Takeaway, she's a bit of a fanatic, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So what happened after that first book? How many books were there?
6 more books, and then also, of course, the 8 movies.
So what's new about this go-around?
So this time it's a play, and it's actually, so it's kind of the 8th Harry Potter story, and it's picking up 19 years after the last book left off. Harry is 37, he's got 3 kids, the Dark Lord is vanquished, and now he's kind of struggling with parenthood and
hence the title,
working.
Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
That's, yeah.
But I'm wondering, does everyone like love the idea of Harry Potter growing up and having adult problems? I mean, do you want to see Calvin and Hobbes, you know, going to college, or the people from Friends, you know, going to nursing homes? I mean, some of the folks you talked to in Kingston, New York over the weekend were a little ambivalent.
He's overworked at the Ministry of Magic, and he's trying to deal with, like, too much work and also having 3 kids, and his background still comes into... I don't know. I don't know how that's going to be. Like, Harry with a desk job? Do I really want to read about that? I don't know.
There was kind of this ambivalence toward all the people that I talked to, or a lot of people I talked to, were really excited but also kind of nervous. This is not the Harry they know. This is not the teenager fighting Voldemort. This is somebody that they don't know, that's not from their childhood or from what the books they remember reading.
And it's a play, not a novel.
That definitely had some people worried about how it would read. J.K. Rowling didn't actually write the play. She created the story and wrote the play with somebody else who's more experienced in writing plays. So that's kind of different.
Now, we should say that Kingston, New York is this Anytown, USA, lovely community right on the Hudson River.
I talked to a bunch of people there. I talked to this one 18-year-old, Isabella, and she was so excited about Harry Potter coming back that she was literally almost in tears.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to feel about that, but it's going to be okay. I'm going to work through it. I'm just excited that she's writing in the same, like, fantasy area again.
Oh, my, needed a hug, apparently.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and there were a lot of people who seemed like that, especially in maybe the 18 to 25 range, who just, this is their childhood. They want this back, and they didn't, you know, they were nervous about it, but they just needed it. They just really needed it. And then there were some other older people who were interesting. You know, I talked to this one guy in his 30s who said that he was really excited, actually, to see these characters grow up. He got into the books later in life. He started reading them only a couple years ago. And so he was kind of, he wanted to see what Harry in his 30s was like.
Like any other, whether fiction story or not, it translates into the real world in some way, shape, or form as the reader interprets it. So you can take each character and kind of get a lesson from them on where they moved in the magical world and what their background is and where they're going to go and their moral compass.
But we're not talking about, like, marriages, divorces, affairs, being tawdry, nasty, awful people like adults are.
So I read the book. I will say that I don't want to give anything away. I want to be very careful. I guess I read the play. It's not really, it's safe for kids to read. So, you know, there's not going to be that, it's not going to be tawdry affairs.
But you're not a kid. You're not a kid. You're a fanatic.
Yes.
And did this work for you?
Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed it. There were some moments where I was like, oh, what? Because it's a play and not one of these rich, you know, 500-600 page books, you just don't get the texture and of the story that you used to. I just loved her descriptions of everything, the character descriptions, what it looked like, what it smelled like, everything. And that just isn't really apparent in a script.
Will we ever see this play produced?
Yes. So right now it's already in London on West End. Tickets are going for crazy amounts of money on the second market, as one could imagine. Could be coming to the U.S. I'm sure that they will try to get as much money out of it as possible.
Move over Hamilton.
Exactly.
Harry Potter's on the way. Isabel Angel, takeaway producer on the launch of the latest installment of Harry Potter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally this hour, the tradition of the high society wedding announcement began in Britain, of course. And if you look in the succinct wedding announcements in the Daily Telegraph, you can see that tradition persists.
The marriage took place on Saturday, July 2nd, 2016 at St. Peter's Church, Kent, between Jeremy, second son of the late Commander Geoffrey Penn and of Mrs. Barbara Penn, and Philippa, younger daughter of Mr. Barry Soden and the late Mrs. Pauline Soden. The Reverend Tim Hatwell officiated, the bride was attended by Mrs. Rachel Pittaway, Mr. Simon Greg Smith was best man.
But in America, as is often the case, we take the tradition and in the innocent quest to outdo, we perhaps overdo. This is from the New York Times. The names have been changed.
Catherine Lamb Chislington and Daniel Hammond Meeker were married July 30th at Trinity Church in Newport, Rhode Island. The Reverend Alan Neal, an Episcopal priest, performed the ceremony. Mr. Hammond Meeker, 32, is the head of the European Equity Capital Markets Syndicate at Bank of America Merrill Lynch in London. The groom's mother is a mindfulness coach, similar to a life coach, based in Bradford-on-Avon. His father is an acupuncturist in Trowbridge. The groom's stepfather is a consultant in child and adolescent psychiatry in Swindon, England.
You get the idea. In the American version, a more elaborate story about the dramatic struggles of a couple just starting out in life who, it would appear, came from nearly nothing. Right. So to this venerable tradition now, a humor writer type from The New Yorker, which is not town and country, couldn't resist a chance to throw mud at the innocent. This piece of satire was published last month in the magazine by Colin Nissen.
Laura Hall and Tom McCoy will be married at the Holy Lutheran Church in Roxbury, New York, on Saturday. The ceremony will be officiated by Robert O'Brien, a longtime friend of the groom, who will stammer through a meandering analogy about how love is like a boat, failing to convince anyone in attendance that love is even remotely like a boat. The bride, 30, graduated summa cum laude from Dartmouth with a BA in education. The groom, 32, graduated magna cum laude from Penn with a BA in economics. This disparity in achievement will be a recurring source of tension for the couple, first rearing its head during their honeymoon in Belize, when the groom will take a little too long to calculate a tip and the bride will step into some of the situation, a phrase the groom will coin in that moment and continue to employ for years to come with diminishing amusement. 2 years later, the couple will have a child and name him Rob Wood. This is not a name that either of them will want, but rather a hard-fought compromise between two names and an early indication that their relationship will suffer from weak problem-solving skills. The suffering of the couple will pale, of course, in comparison with that of Rob Wood.
Colin Nissen is a writer and contributor to The New Yorker, and he says he's been wanting to do this for a long time.
I would say probably the last 10 years I've been reading those. Just kind of feel drawn to read these stories every week.
As an author and as a writer, these are the things you do when you're procrastinating.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, I'm just fascinated by them. These stories, I just think they're amazing. They're such intimate little peeks into people's lives. You know,
is there an audio voice that's the equivalent of the snarky takedown that you do in this New Yorker piece?
You know, for me, I don't know if you saw the Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, yeah.
I somehow heard Alec Baldwin's narration in there because it's got that kind of straight, flat.
The serious, I'm a little mad kind of Alec Baldwin.
Exactly, but I'm going to keep it. I'm going to keep it right here.
What are the submission guidelines?
They're very detailed in what the people need to put in there. You know,
but apparently the advice is not be yourself, be really authentic.
I don't think that's one of the things. No.
No. Is there a length issue if with the Times? Do they say keep it under blank number of words? Because extended in this operatic form here has a certain beauty.
Some of them have. In the Times, some of them are pretty long. I think they kind of – if somebody has an extra special, perfect life and perfect story, they'll extend it. And some of them are pretty long.
As a author and, I guess, here, comedy writer, just kind of spin out the narrative. How did your mind work to put this together? Because it is truly genius.
You know, for me, I guess it, just these lives, like you said, are just so perfect. They're so perfect. And there's such these weird little intimate glimpses into people's lives, and then you're out, and then you don't know what happened. So what happened? Like, I was just so curious to see what would happen next. So for these two, yeah, just things get weird pretty quickly for them.
Distrust will fester in the years that follow. The groom will spend longer hours in the city where he works as a financial analyst at Rowe and Barnes. It is there that he will meet Kate, a young Yale grad whose smile will remind him of the bride's in the days before she started wearing a night guard. The groom will kiss Kate in her cubicle during a company party. He will feel young and alive. She will taste like Tic Tacs and Yale. Everyone comes to a kind of bad suburban end here. Is that parody? Is that actual sociology? What do we think? Is there tragedy stalking the marriage announcements, the wedding announcements in the New York Times?
I think I just brought my own fears to this thing, you know, because my wife and I, we live in Brooklyn, but we searched in the suburbs. A panic set in, you know, and just your worst fears of what you imagine the suburbs would be, even though tons of people, including my friends, love the suburbs. But in my mind, I just took all the fears that I would imagine and kind of put them in there.
Well, they're all here.
Yeah, they're there.
It occurs to me that maybe this experience you've had, a short time later, his relationship with Kate will end outside a photo booth when the peculiarity of their union will become evident in not one, but all four photos. Apparently, she's dating a much older man, and it only becomes pointless in the photo booth.
Yeah, that's the moment. That's the moment where it all became clear.
What responses have you gotten from this?
They've been, it's funny. It's a lot of, wow, that was dark. Like people, I get a lot of, damn, that's depressing, you know, but hopefully there's some laughs mixed in there.
Do you think the New York Times is the only one that has this? I mean, is there any other place for this? Where did this come from? It looks like Town and Country. Is it Saturday Evening Post? Is there some ancient history to this? Because it does feel a little bit like, I mean, I see the long skirts and the weird tennis rackets and the black and white footage in my brain going when I'm reading this.
That's amazing. Yeah, I would imagine this happened before the New York Times. Somebody must have done it, right? Parents announcing the birth with some fanfare. I would think so.
It's all just been reduced to this little place in the Times.
Yeah. I'd enjoy that section so much more if there was some honesty, if they mixed in some more honesty to it. You know, if there were some pieces that were like, yeah, it's not so great. Yeah, he's pretty cool. We'll see what happens.
Oh, Colin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Colin Nissen is a writer and contributor to The New Yorker. Here's a little something to take with you today. For years, skydiver Luke Aikens planned not to kill himself by jumping from a plane not wearing a parachute, dropping for 2 minutes in free fall, and not smashing on the rocks, dying a terrible death where only dental records could identify poor Luke. Well, he actually did it over the weekend. He landed in a specially designed net and survived. Whew. Working with a net, you know? Donald Trump should try that. Seriously. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.